Very good. So today's talk, insight, because often somebody mentioned in passing, well, does all these deep meditations or experience of meditation, does that change your life? So what, you get into a blissful state, is there anything lasting there? And so today I'm going to talk about insight, how that sometimes through calming the mind down so much, it gives you the opportunity to see things from a different angle. It's as if we're always conditioned by habit to see things in one way and one way only. And when we get very, very still, it allows us to see things in a different way, a unique way. Like I said, I think yesterday or sometime, about exploring what is this you're holding up. And what this means is you see the things you've seen before. You explore old knowledge, which means that you're picking up over the same stuff, but to go to a totally different angle, a different way of seeing things. That is where we get what we call insight. And there's many examples of that. And just how easy it is, you know, to actually to use our insight to let go of things so we're more free. First of all, it's the insight of where are the problems of life? It's years ago. It's amazing, when you get old, you start to say, years ago. Or when I was it's an admission of my age. But I get to go to very interesting conferences and presentations, just because in a conference, they've seen all of the old stuff so many times. So that they say, well, you know, if you get something a little bit different, something unexpected, it jogs people's mind and maybe they can see different things. So it was one of the conferences I went to about 3 years ago, was being invited to Daejeon in South Korea for the, I forget, was it 7th or 8th, World Computer Conference. And if any of you see me in that room there, trying to send an email and getting frustrated and then calling in one of the other monks for tech support, you will know that I don't know why I would be qualified to go to the World Computer Conference. Not just to go there, but to be invited to give the keynote address at the plenary session. So just when the minister in South Korea is responsible for IT, and the mayor and the president of the World Computer Conference Society, whatever it was, after they gave their introductions, that I was next on the stage. And they wondered, who's he? What's he doing here? A Buddhist monk. And so that's when I didn't have many visual aids, but I did take up my bottle of water, that's all I had on the stage, and did the what is this exercise. And of course I never knew what I was doing, but they participated, bottle of water, plastic, environmental damage or whatever. All these ideas came up. And then, what is it? Until they started understanding what innovation really is. Where you see things from a different way, a different angle. See an old object in a way you've never seen it before. And from that, you get some innovation. And actually, to get innovation, when you just get the same crowd doing the same things in the same way, the things just start to almost like die. There's no sort of spur to have new breakthroughs. And I told them a very simple story of a breakthrough in food, which happened in the St. Louis World's Fair. And it's just an example of just how insight, new ways of doing things occur. And that was where they have food stalls on these occasions. And on that food stalls, they're just by chance, by coincidence, by luck, the person who got the permission to sell ice cream was sighted exactly next to the person who was selling American waffles. Now, the waffles you have for breakfast, like pancakes. So the waffle guy and the ice cream guy were next to each other for days and days, and they got talking to one another, and they became friendly, and they decided to experiment, to combine waffles with ice cream. And that was the start of the ice cream cone, which you buy in shops these days, which if you look at it, is a thin, dry, crispy waffle with ice cream on the top. That's where it originated from. So I said, I don't know what's going to come out of this conference in Dijon, but who knows? You may have a breakthrough. A monk and a computer program. Who knows where that might happen, where that might lead. I don't know where it exactly led, but at least they gave a nice donation to one of my projects. So I was happy. So this is innovation. Sometimes it's seeing things from a different angle. Like another, it was not so much a conference, but it was the 100th anniversary or something of the observatory, which was in King's Park in Perth. And they wanted to put on some sort of ceremony. And I don't know why, but they always think, especially Buddhist monks, that we're really sort of like spaced out and that we're really sort of up in the stars and we're a nice person or group of people to anything which is to do with space. It must be because as somebody told me that I used to say that, did anyone, first of all, just remember that, those TV shows called Star Trek with Captain Kirk and Starship Enterprise? To boldly go where no monk has gone before. Not boldly, but baldly go. So ordaining nuns and doing all this sort of stuff. But anyway, that even in astronomy, I know a little bit about astrophysics and stuff, so sometimes I know what I'm talking about, and that just really scares some of these other people. They'd rather have a religious figure who doesn't really know what they're talking about, who they can sort of confute. But then, at this particular conference or presentation, there was a scientist, an astronomer, but she was a devout Catholic. And I respect her because she was just honest with some of the conflict she had between her religious life and a professional job as an astronomer. And then what she said, the comment she made, was every time I look in the telescope and see the vast array of stars, of comets, of the galaxies in this incredibly huge universe, my faith is challenged. And as a scientist, I said, I understand that, because whenever you look the other way in the telescope, from the big end to the small end, and you try and gaze, who's watching all of this, then science gets challenged. You can see the big universe out there, but what is it? It's actually watching it. And that's where science always gets really, my word is discombobulated. Even they called it the ghost in the machine, and the machine being the human body, and this ghost, this thing which the consciousness, the awareness, the will, all of that, that is what really challenges science. And so, I said, it's 50-50, you don't need to be afraid or ashamed, because now, you know, we want to find out, get that insight, look the other way. Who's doing all of this? Who's responsible? Who's to blame for my life? Because people love blaming. In other words, maybe, you know, your parents, because I don't know why, but maybe they could have abused you or treated you badly or not done the right thing, or sometimes you may have had wonderful parents. Or it could have been your teachers. There was that fellow who, he was at Harvard Law School, and he didn't pass the final exam or something. He didn't get high enough marks to get a place in a prestigious law firm. So he sued his teachers for neglect or for not teaching him, not making sure he passed. And that's a weird thing. And then sometimes people get the idea, maybe sue your parents. If my parents had loved me more, then I wouldn't have become a monk or something. I don't know. If my teachers... Oh, if people always blame others. And that is one of the insights. Turn it around. And you say that, well, sometimes... I say this to married couples. They come up and say, oh, my husband is like this, my husband is like that, my husband is just, oh, he's not the man I expected him to be. It's amazing how much a monk knows about marriage. And they say, what about you, the wife? Well, yeah, I'm not really that perfect. And I've got my mistakes and my faults as well. I say, well, there we are. You're a match. And I think this was ABC Young Beng Chu told me this story. That when she, I think it was actually a personal story. I never actually checked it, but it was someone she knew very, very well. That when they got married, and her father took aside her new husband and gave him some fatherly advice, or father-in-law advice, to his new son-in-law, saying, you probably think my daughter is wonderful. He said, oh yeah, I must be the luckiest man in the whole of Singapore to have married someone like that. You must think she's so beautiful and gorgeous and in every way. Yes, even the way she picks her nose is charming. They've actually said that, but you get the message. And he said, yeah, that's what it's like when you fall in love in the first years of marriage. Everything about your partner is absolutely perfect. But, said the father-in-law, after 2 years, maybe 3 years, you will start to see the faults and defects in my daughter. And when you start to see the things wrong with her, I want you to always remember this word of advice. If my daughter hadn't had those defects to begin with, she'd have married someone much better than you. It's always someone else's fault. But then, okay, we're part of this. And it's not really a fault. So that's why, when we have insight, I look at my own faults. All the stupid things like that hammer I told you about the other day. And so many other things which I do which were wrong and were stupid. But I've come to the practice these days. When I do something stupid and wrong, I love telling people about it. And that means you grow in wisdom. So your insight means you're becoming wiser, not more depressed and repeating the same faults over and over again. Such as, it just comes to mind, such as, what did I, I'm not quite sure what I said in the first week of this retreat. But anyway, that's one of my thoughts as well. There was, I don't think I've said this one to you. There was an emergency call. There was somebody dying in the hospital. And they were in the ICU and they needed quickly someone to do some Buddhist chanting. And I'm a very compassionate monk, and so I said, okay, I'll be there as soon as I can. And so I got in the car, stopped what I was doing, went over to the Royal Perth Hospital, saw the family outside, into the ICU, not much time to talk. And this is elderly Chinese man in a coma, dying. And all the family, because you can only have one or two people next to the bed in the ICU. And so I was by the bedside there. And you know, sometimes, believe it or not, I got some really strong chanting. I really gave it 100%. Not keeping anything back. I chanted and really put, it's not just the words, it's where it's coming from. You get your whole heart, your mind, all your powers together, just blast him. Well, not, and that's figuratively speaking. And I gave him superpower chanting. And it worked. He came out of the coma, he started recovery. And some of the, you know, the, sometimes it can happen. So even the doctors were a bit surprised. And, but the family was so upset with me. They were so angry. And I thought, why? Why are you upset? You know, your patriarch of the family is going to recover. He said, we took days off work in Singapore, in Hong Kong or Taiwan, wherever they came from. And we arranged a funeral already. It's already arranged and paid for. And now you've messed up all our plans. He's going to recover. Now he's going to... We're going to have to go home to Taiwan or to Korea, wherever we're from. And we're going to have to come back in maybe 6 months or a year. When he sort of really dies, he's going to die anyway, he's really old. But next time, we're not going to invite you to give him a shot. I said, look, why blame me? You didn't tell me what chanting you wanted. There is the get better chant or the die peaceful chant. Not my fault. So, from that mistake, sometimes I think, oh, you know, people always want to get healthy, but in this case, no, they just want to die peaceful. So anyway, so whenever I do any chanting for anybody, I usually ask that now. Which one do you want? Die peaceful or get better? And sometimes one of the family says, die peaceful. And the other one says, no, get better. Make up your mind and I'll do the chanting. So anyway, so when I do make mistakes like that, tell other people about it. So they enjoy just the fact that human beings do make mistakes. But we learn. It means that you're not some God up in heaven who can never make a mistake. You're not some robot, you admit your mistakes. It's not so much humility as much as how we learn. So that's the insight which I get whenever I make mistakes. I don't blame other people. It's a waste of time blaming other people. It just makes me hurt. I don't expect people to be perfect. And that insight is very easy. I don't expect other people to be perfect. You know why? Because I'm not perfect. In other words, I make mistakes, idiosyncrasies, do things a bit wrong, and you laugh about it. So, this is where our insight, instead of blaming your suffering on others, looking outside for solutions to the problems of your own life, you look inside instead. It's not someone else's fault. It's my fault, if anything. It's not really a fault, but I look inside. When I look inside, You can always find some sort of solution to anything which happens in your life. When I look for the inside solution, then there's always something I can do about it. So whether it's sickness, I already mentioned about some of the sicknesses which you have to endure in life, some of the pain and difficulties. And instead of blaming others, see what you can do about it. It's the old simile, rather light a candle than complain about darkness. Many people can complain about the world, but how about doing something about it? So you can do something, see what happens. But instead of complaining and talking and having another conference, we try and go inside and do something ourselves. Find out how we can be more peaceful human beings. So when I don't complain about others but actually do something about it, you can't do that much, but you do a little bit, and somebody else does a little bit, it becomes a better place. But when we're blaming others, we're getting nowhere. So even like when it's sickness, instead of blaming others, always actually look inside and what is this sickness? And what's wrong with being sick? And that was one of the great insights when I was sick. And people ask, you know, what's wrong with you? You go to see the doctor and you say, what's wrong with you today? And sometimes, how hard it must be to be a doctor when you tell the doctor it hurts, I'm in pain. Yeah, well, exactly where? How? And it's very difficult to explain to another person how they're in pain. Please, again, if I repeated this, the first talk, I do so many talks, not just here, but other places, about the man who went to see the doctor. He said, what's wrong? He said, I'm in pain. What? In pain? Where? He said, everywhere. What do you mean you're in pain everywhere? Well, he said, I touch my forehead and it hurts. I touch my ear and it's painful. Touch my nose and it's painful. I touch my breast and it's painful. I touch my bottom and it's painful. I touch my knee and it's painful. It's painful everywhere. And I said, I know your problem. You've got a broken finger. See, that's insight. And of course, I got that insight from a joke book, which you get lots of insights. It just stories, ways of describing stuff. So, what do you do when you're sick? Number one, the insight into sickness. It's natural. It's part of life. Please put your hand up if there's anyone in this room who's never been sick in their life. Can I assume one of two theories, either you're deaf, or you didn't hear the question, or you have had sickness from time to time. In fact, going on from that premise, if you had put your hand up and you'd never been sick in your life so far, you would be weird. You would be so strange. You would be so unique that they would take you into the university hospitals and do experiments on you. How come this person has never been sick in your life? It's extraordinary. There'd be something very weird and wrong with you if you weren't sick. So, from that I deduce, if you ever do become sick, and you go and see your GP, your doctor, you must always tell your doctor, Doctor, there's something right with me. I'm sick again. Because when you say that, there's something right with me, you're taking away the stigma of sickness. Sickness is not to be regarded as a personal failure. there's something wrong with you, that you're sick. Because turning things around the other way to get great insights, there was a book I read as a student that was called Erewhon. It was the word nowhere spelt backwards by Samuel Butler. At its time, it became quite influential because it was like a sci-fi, but not really sort of outer space, but finding a society in the planet Earth which had evolved by itself without contact with others and had a unique take on, say, illness. If anybody did get sick, like have the flu, it was punishable in the court of law. You should take better care of yourself. It's your fault if you get the flu. You should exercise, eat good food like baked beans. And so, there was this scene of a middle-aged man who was accused in this court of law, in this society, of having a cold. And it was prima facie evidence because he was in the dock sneezing and coughing. That's just like that, yes. There, you've admitted that you are guilty, you have a cold. Now comes the sentencing. Because you have a cold, you're infecting so many other people in this city with that virus. You're taking time off work. You are not contributing to the community. And it's so difficult when people look at you. And because of that, you're guilty. And this is not your first offense either. I've seen you having a cold before. And I warned you last time, if you don't take better care of your health and have a cold, you're a menace to society. And I'll tell you, I'll put you in the jail for a long time. Yeah, you too. So I put this man in jail for a long time. No, not being healthy, it's your fault. And then, there was a person who had robbed a bank. What did they rob the bank for? He said, well, I don't know. It's just, it's almost like a disease I have, like kleptomania. I just have to get the money. And he said, okay, so if you don't go to jail for robbing the bank, you get like a therapist, a doctor. Because it's looked upon as being a sickness. Crime was looked upon as being a sickness, and sickness was looked upon as being a crime. And sometimes you look at that and maybe there's something to that. I'm not sure if you heard the story about, I've got the article in my bag somewhere. There was this gentleman in the United States recently, and he went into a bank, took out a gun, it was a toy gun, pointed at the cashier and said, I'm robbing the bank, give me your money. And the bank's policy, in many places these days, no confrontation. So he handed over the money. And the gentleman, who was reasonably elderly, just took the money and then went to the foyer of the bank and sat down. Didn't try to escape, just sat down. And when the security came, he said, yeah, it was me. I robbed the bank. I'm the one you're looking for. And when he went to the trial a day or two later, he said, I was guilty, no need for a trial. And I said, well, what do you do it for? He said, well, I've got a very bad relationship with my wife, and I told her I'd rather be in jail than live with you, and so I decided to rob a bank, so now please put me in jail. You know what the judge did? No, he put him in home detention. That's a really mean judge. But you say like karma maybe deserved it. I don't know. But anyway, so the insight is understands life in a different way. Instead of trying to flee from your wife, you know, just, well, if you're having a bad relationship, see what you can do. Whose fault is it? The insight, which always comes up, says it's not her fault, it's not my fault. I mentioned already, it's always our fault. We're in it together. We blame others. Of course, it doesn't work. Blame ourselves. That doesn't work. Blame us. So we get it together ourselves, between us. So anyway, and one of the biggest problems we find, even in meditation and in life, always, it first came about when I really sort of got hold of this and understood this, was when there was a nun staying at Bodhinyana Monastery a long time ago. And she was meditating. She was a really good meditator. And that, you know, she'd get to that point, getting nimittas coming up, really strong nimittas. And I thought, wow, this is really good. You know, she's going to sort of have a jhana soon. But she never did. She got close, and then it didn't work. And I just taught her everything I knew about, you know, how to sort of, you know, like be like Ajahn Chah in the still forest pool. Just be very still and be very patient. Just let it be. This is good enough. You're happy to be where you are. You know, all the tricks of the trade. Tricks of the trade. But nothing worked. And I was actually quite intrigued. Well, why? Why is a very gifted meditator not going deeper? And then she got the insight and told me. And she said that I figured out why I couldn't go deeper. It's because I don't think I deserve to get jhanas. I don't deserve to be happy. And how many people in our world, for something which happened in the past, some lingering feeling of guilt or lack of self-worth, feel they don't deserve to be liberated? And that shocked me, but it also was just, oh, of course you deserve it. And it was just, it was actually pain in my own heart to feel that people have that as one of the last barriers to overcome to get into deep meditation. Which is one of the reasons why, you know, we do things like metta meditation. It's one of the reasons why the insight meditation. There's another girl here, a young Indonesian girl on a retreat, who was also just, she was suffering. She was just, you know what it made it worse? When she was meditating, she opened her eyes and saw everybody meditating really peacefully. And saw others with a big smile on their face. And that really pissed her off. Excuse the language, but everyone else was happy and she was miserable. And so she came, she wanted to leave the retreat. She said, I'm terrible, just see all these people smiling just makes my misery worse. And see them all meditating and I'm restless and I can't sit for a few minutes and I don't know what I'm doing here. This is not a happy retreat for me at all. I feel so upset and miserable. And that was where for her. Can you relate to that sometimes? A few people say yes. So for her, how can you teach a person like that to let go? Just let it be. It's okay. It's good enough. So that was for her. I know where I do the interviews. The office is right next door. So I quickly went into the office, so turned on the computer, and I must have been, you know, amazingly fast. Because, you know, she was still out there when I came back with the very first, the original grumpy license, which I put on our monastery letterhead, the official letterhead. And I chose like Gothic script, like you get when you get a university degree, or like a marriage license or something. This wasn't like a marriage license or a driving license. This was a grumpy license. And it read that this certificate, this license, permits to the holder freedom to feel grumpy at any time, for any reason, or no reason whatsoever, at any time for the rest of her life, signed Ajahn Brahmawangsa, and dated too. And I presented her the very first grumpy license, so she didn't need to feel that she was doing anything wrong. She had permission for me to be grumpy for the rest of her life. So if anybody said, why are you so grumpy? He said, because I've got a license to be grumpy. And as soon as I gave it to her, she was happy for the rest of the retreat. As soon as you got permission not to be happy, then you're happy. See the stupid way our mind works? It's just we're always seeking permission for people. And we think that maybe if I'm happy, other people aren't happy. It doesn't work like that. It's not like there's only a certain amount of happiness in the world, and if you take it all for yourself, there's nothing left for others. The more you have, the more it spreads. That's why that sometimes when I travel, sometimes you have to declare any sicknesses you have, any diseases, especially when you enter different countries. Have you got any infectious diseases? I say, I have. I've got an infectious disease which is very contagious. Hepatitis B. You heard it correctly, not hepatitis, that's terrible. Hepatitis. Hepatitis B. And if you hang around too close, you know, you'll get infected. So there's a great deal of insight in this. And it all comes from just when you are meditating and you become peaceful. It's like your mind becomes free and you can actually like start again, see things in a different way, open up another page, get great insights. And you know what happens with many people? The old difficulty we have, especially as we get older, remembering people's names. And that's really tough for me, because there's many, many, many people I see, and many, many people I talk with, and many people, and they come up to me and say, hey, do you remember me? And when I'm honest, you can't lie, that's a trouble, difficult being a monk. You say no. And they get really upset. So you know what I say? I don't say that. I say, you're the person's name I keep forgetting. Which is true. And it's not so down-putting. But anyway, just sometimes what happens is you just don't force the memory. Just leave it alone. And then you're talking about something else and then the name comes up. What is that phenomena of like delayed memory?
Getting old.
No, it's not getting old. It's dementia. You know, in one of those conferences over in, I think, Renchi Hospital in Singapore, and it was about dementia, recognizing the signs of dementia, and the I think it was a member of the Buddhist Fellowship who was a doctor there, you know, just one of the experts on dementia. He started telling the signs of dementia, and I was really shocked. When I got up to say my piece and say, oh my goodness, you just said, the good doctor just said, that a good sign of signs of dementia are that you forget the past, you don't plan for the future, and you're socially disengaged. That's what I've been telling all my monks and meditators and nuns to do that for a long time. I'm a major cause of dementia. But anyway, if you have a problem to solve, a difficult problem, this is how I solve those problems myself or do it with others and teach others to solve difficult problems. Put all the data in, your brain, your memory, whatever, your computer. You gather all the data and then you leave it for a while. You leave it to sort of compute, to work its way through the system. So I've got a problem of how I'm going to do this, how I'm going to do that. And then enough data and then leave it. And I'm very good at leaving things and letting it go. And I just leave it, let it go. And the weird thing is that when you're peaceful, calm, the answer pops up. It just comes. It's like it's figured its way through your brain, your subconscious or whatever, and then the answer comes. And those answers which come from silence, from insight, they are great answers. And if any of you, I don't know if any of you have managed to find the secret garden. Do you know where the secret garden is in this place? Of course I can't tell you because it's a secret. Or should I do this? Oh, okay, let's do this little story. Come on. About the monastery in the Himalayas. It's in one of my books. Yeah. Okay, here it comes. There was this Australian guy, and he went trekking in Ladakh. And, you know, he wasn't following the orders of the guide. He was lingering, taking a photograph here, taking a photograph there. And the guide said, keep up. But he was lingering. And when the party went one way, thinking he was following the track, he went another way and got separated from the main party. And, it was like late afternoon, sun was going down. And he got lost in the foothills of the Himalayas in Ladakh. And he knew it was a dangerous place. There were bears and leopards in the area. So, it was not sort of a small matter. He had to find some shelter soon. It's also getting cold. But fortunately, when the light went down, he saw the lights of some sort of building not that far away. So he walked towards it. It was a monastery, a Buddhist monastery there in the foothills of Ladakh. And because it was wilderness area, the abbot just said, okay, yes, this happens. So we always give accommodation to people who are lost for the night. And seeing he was like a big Westerner, he said, well, look, a lot of our monks sleep on the floor, but, because you're a big fellow, I'll let you sleep in my bed in my room, because it's a nice bed with a mattress on. I can sleep somewhere else. And even the abbot gave him his own bed for the night. So they gave him something to eat, and he settled in. He had a really sort of deep sleep until the middle of the night he was woken up. And he was woken up by this unworldly sound, like heavenly music. It wasn't sort of loud, but it was just got right into him. And he was like thrilled with this pity, with tears were strolling. He never heard anything so beautiful. And that was the last thing he remembered when he woke up in the morning after a deep night's sleep. The most beautiful music he'd ever heard. And anyway, after the breakfast, the abbot said, well, we know where your group is going, so one of the monks will take you. It's not that far away. And the Australian man thanked the abbot and just said, oh, just by the way, in the middle of the night, I heard this amazing music. Where did it come from? And the abbot stopped and said, oh, that. You heard it too. He said, yeah, it's wonderful, because I was in your room. And the abbot said, "I'm sorry, sir, but I can't tell you the source of that music. It's against our rules." And the Australian thought he was just looking for a donation. So he's told the abbot, "How much?" And the abbot said, "No, it's not about money. It's you know, one of these old secrets of this monastery. Only monks could know the source of that sound." So the Australian got $200 out. He said, "No, I don't care if you give me $1,000,000. No one can know the source of that sound except for monks." And the Australian argued, but you know, he had to go and get the rejoin the tour, so off he went. But when he came back to Sydney, this Australian fellow, he just couldn't get this music out of his head. He was obsessing about it. He was almost like addicted to this music. It was just right inside of him. He went to counsellors, psychologists, psychiatrists. They couldn't help him at all. It was driving him crazy. So there's only one solution. The next summertime, he went back to India. He went into Ladakh, found that monastery, made an appointment with the abbot, and said to the abbot, "I'm going mad in Sydney. I have to find the source of that sound." And the abbot said, "Look, I told you before, I can't tell you, I can only tell monks." "Exactly," said the Australian, "ordain me as a monk." It's either that or go crazy. So this Australian started the long process for ordination. Just like in Bodhinyana Monastery, 2 years before you can ordain. For those 2 years they went by, he learnt his meditation and chanting and precepts, and it was his big day, his ordination day. And the ordination ceremony passed without a flaw. And as soon as the ordination ceremony was finished and he was a monk, he asked the abbot, "Now, tell me what that sound was. I've sacrificed so much." And the abbot said, "I'll do better than that. Tonight, I will show you what that sound is. Come to my room around midnight." And of course, even though it was very busy and exciting with the ordination, the Australian new monk was not sleepy at all. He was up all night, and when it came to, actually before midnight, he was at the abbot's door. He knocked and just went in, and the abbot said, "Just wait for a little bit longer." And just about midnight, the abbot said, "Are you really ready for this? It's very shocking what you might find." He said, "Look, I have to find out. 3 whole years I've waited." "Okay," said the abbot. And he pulled aside a curtain on his room, and there was this old wooden door, ancient. I don't know how long this monastery had been up in the Himalayas, but you know, Buddhas have been around a long time. We were saying the other day, you know, even just previous Buddhas, who knows how long this door had been there. It was an ancient old wooden door. And the monk took out this solid wooden key, put it in the lock and turned it. He had to force it a little bit because, you know, it hadn't been opened for a long time. And then pull the door open. And there was a long, dark passageway. And as they started walking down this passageway, the music started. Second time he'd ever heard this music. And this Australian was shaking with excitement and with joy. He could hear it clearer, and he was soon going to find out the end of his quest for 3 years to find out what was making this unearthly, beautiful music. He'd been to the Sydney Opera House and listened to the Berlin Philharmonic and so many other great musical performances, but this was in a totally different league. And at the end of that corridor, he saw there was an iron door. Solid iron. A little bit rusty, but really thick and heavy. And the abbot had to get this iron key out. Turn the lock. Open the door, which maybe hadn't been open for a century, I don't know. And walk through. And as they walked through into another corridor, the sound was even clearer. And this was almost like ecstasy. It was thrilling him. He was just so high that tears were flowing down his cheeks as he could hear the sound even more. At the end of the corridor, a silver door. Solid silver, worth a fortune. "Are you okay?" said the abbot. And even though the fellow was shaking, a bit wobbly on his legs, "I've come this far, let's go through." So he took out another silver key and just opened the door. And then another corridor. But he realized this must be the last of the corridors. Because at the end of that corridor was a golden door, solid gold, hewed from the mountains a long time ago, encrusted with precious, priceless jewels. This was worshipped with whatever human beings could worship, with gold and jewelry, the most precious of gems. Because what lie behind that door was the source of the most incredible, thrilling, unworldly, unearthly music. His heart was pounding, sweat, tears coming from him. It wasn't just the end of a quest. It was something supernatural he was about to see. And as the abbot put the key into the door, he half turned it and then he stopped. He turned to the Australian, the new monk. "Are you really sure you want to see this? It's known to drive people, some people crazy, mad, out of their mind. It's just so hard to comprehend and to know that such things exist. Are you sure you really want to know this?" He said, "If you don't open that door, I'll go crazy anyway. Please, you must." And so the abbot opened the door. You know what they saw? "I can't tell you, you're not monks." And that is the insight into curiosity. Why do you want to know anyway? Nothing to do with the Dhamma. Sadhu.